This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wherediddtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go? I have once again as my guest in studio, Mr. Peter Robbins. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Soraya.
Why am I not hearing you? I turned on the wrong mic. Say hello again.
Hi, Soraya.
That's way better. Oh, so there's this weird synchronicity that keeps happening when you're here. And it is totally not planned and not in any way organized. But for anyone who doesn't know, this is not does not start as a podcast. It is an actual radio show on a commercial FM station in Ithaca, New York, where you happen to live, as do I. So it works out nicely. And I do two other shows on the station. I do the one after this, which is more or less a metal, an underground music show that focuses a lot on metal. But I also do a dealer's choice show, and you've joined me on that before.
Yes, great fun.
And I do that once every month or two during the day on Saturday. And it seems that every time I do it, I have you that night as a guest on Where Did the Road Go? And it's totally not planned because I picked those dates kind of at random, and I just, you know, throw out what I have open to you to see when you're going to be in town, and I always look at it and go, oh, look, I have Peter again as a guest.
That deserves a full university study, if you ask me.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure that may be a very interesting study. But I just thought it was an interesting synchronicity because it's by no means planned, but it's happened at least three times now. And you've been on the Dealer's Choice show once, splitting music with me and talking about different stuff.
Yeah, look forward to doing that again. That was great fun.
It was. And yes, looking forward to having you back on that as well. All right. So tonight, first of all, you went to a conference with Travis Walton.
I did. In fact, it was Travis Walton's conference. He talked to me over 3 years ago about wanting to do a conference in the area where he had had his now world-famous experience, which was actually 39 years ago last week. And one of the features of the event was folks got to go out to that location with him and walk the walk through it. But otherwise, it was a remarkable first-time conference with a terrific speakers lineup, a great camaraderie between the folks who were working it, speaking at it, and attending it, in part because we were really all there together in an area and a venue very non-standard for UFO conference. In fact, it was a repurposed weatherized barn. And there was no, like, regulation hotel complex nearby. People stayed at smaller hotels, condos. I stayed in a big old lodge that Travis had rented for myself and some of the other speakers, and it was overall great fun, and always quite a shake-up to be driving and all of a sudden realize, oh, I'm in Arizona. This is not Kansas anymore. Beautiful Arizona, and during the days in the 70s and the nights out in the Heber area, very much like the nights in Ithaca area.
All right. Well, was it well attended being out in the middle of nowhere?
The attendance varied. It certainly would have been more if it was in a more accessible location. But we had usually 100, 150 or so.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah. And
Was it more than one day?
It actually began on Thursday morning, about 30 miles away in the town of Henderson, on Thursday morning, Arizona, where the old police department and courthouse building was that everything relative to the case kind of spun around.
Right.
It is now the Navajo County Historical Society Museum, and a wonderful local museum with a historic courthouse, the buildings from 1898. But it's the building where Travis's colleagues, his co-workers, went that night to report that he'd been taken. It's the building out of which the search and rescue crews left day after day for 5 days to try to find him or his body. And it's the building that was depicted in the film version of his great book, Fire in the Sky, and where the polygraphs were administered. Mm. So we did a press conference there the first morning for press, local, and for anybody that wanted to be there, a lot of local folks. One of the original search and rescue guys 39 years ago. And then on Friday morning, Travis and I basically welcomed the guests. We started right off with Stanton Friedman, our first speaker, and he was in great form considering his heart problems this summer.
Yeah.
In fact, this is the third month in 3 months that I've been on a docket with him, and he's doing great.
I heard something about him retiring potentially.
Well, if so, you wouldn't know it from the past 3 months. He is roaring. He's
oh, good.
Best form I've ever seen him. And I realized the first time I heard him speak was probably 27 years ago.
Wow.
And right after him, Rich Dolan. And then a really remarkable triumvirate. Chris Moody, Stan Milford, and Jonathan Dover. I had never heard them before. Clifford is a Zuni Indian tribe elder. And he talked about literally anomalous phenomena from a Native American point of view, UFOs,
really?
Et cetera, and that it is so deeply ingrained into the Zuni culture and so many others. Stan and John also gave a remarkable presentation. Jonathan is recently retired. Stan is an active Navajo law enforcement ranger. And their talk, in a way, was kind of two-part, three-part, in that Clifford spoke first. And then these guys, remarkable guys, they talked about what they do in terms of the law enforcement that they're charged with. And it's everything conventional, but it also crosses over into, there's so many treasures that are part of the locations in Navajo culture. And they're out there in the open, you know, in pueblos and the like. There's such a lively, attractive market in these things as collectibles that some of their work is about recovery and tracking people who steal these things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
And then they showed a lot of the gear that they work with and things. I wouldn't want to tangle with these guys. The Navajo Rangers are amazingly well-trained, and they have a huge terrain. It's over 20,000 square miles
wow.
that they patrol. And the talk ended with them talking about applying modern investigative techniques from law enforcement personnel, informed by their tradition, their culture, what they learned, you know, in the culture, applying to law enforcement, about UFO sightings, Bigfoot, and so many other anomalous reports that they get in law enforcement as Navajo Rangers. But it was great fun and completely educational for me. I'm always a bit humbled speaking at so many conferences over the course of a year. When I meet speakers that really teach me something, and these guys certainly did.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Writer Chris O'Brien, whose newest book is on the...
Stalking the Herd.
Yeah. Livestock
mutilations
yeah. was very
and it's
chilling.
An epic piece of work, too. It's like 600 pages long.
It is. It's a big book, and he's been researching it a long time. And so he kind of gave us an across-the-board survey. That night ended with really some entertainment, a good band dancing, and weather very much like Ithaca, New York at night, high 20s. On Saturday morning, we kicked off immediately with Linda Moulton Howe, went to Jim Dilatoso, who for decades really has been an image analyst, and he focused in on the imagery generated by the Phoenix Lights.
Mm.
After him, the great Don Schmidt talked about Roswell, again, from a wonderful point of view, and an expanded version of his and Tom Carey's, what I think, phenomenal book, extraordinary book they wrote about the Roswell witnesses, Witness to Roswell being the title of the book, where they have now interviewed some 600 individuals in the greater Roswell area, most of whom are gone now, but they're now focusing in again on the children of these witnesses and their memories, and in some cases their contact with Army Air Corps law enforcement, which was very chilling across the board, as you know. I think certainly far and away one of the most moving talks of the whole weekend was going to be scheduled for Saturday. We had to do it on Sunday because Tracy Torme had a health issue. I hadn't seen Tracy in over 25 years, and if that name sounds vaguely familiar to some of your more lucid, literate, musical folks going back a ways, Tracy's dad was a legendary crooner going back to the 40s, the great Mel Torme.
That's what I figured,
But Tracy, for my money, is the finest screenwriter in Hollywood in terms of his true grasp of the complexities of presenting the UFO subject and its implications in film and television. I first met Tracy in the early 90s when he was doing the treatment for CBS miniseries called Intruders, which was sort of a hybrid between Bud Hopkins' huge international bestseller of that name and his earlier book, Missing Time, which they kind of grafted together.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, Intruders was the first book I read from Bud Hopkins.
Good one to start on.
Yes, yeah.
And Tracy also wrote the screenplay for Fire in the Sky, which for really since it came out has been the target of both praise and derision because of the way that the onboard sequences were portrayed, which were not authentic. And some speakers, you know, they're up there, and they hold your interest. It waxes and it wanes a bit, but you're there with them. Other ones, you can't miss a word of what they're saying. You don't want to. And Tracy talked about the whole behind-the-scenes thing of meeting Travis, getting this project up and running, and the crisis that caused the rewrite. And it's really worth sharing with your audience. For any of you that haven't seen Fire in the Sky, the film, it's a perfectly schizophrenic film in that half of it works really well, I think. The very human half, talking about and portraying the tremendous stresses, the shocks in the lives of everybody that was touched by this. The consternation of law enforcement, who in some cases knew these young guys their whole life. They, you know, were rough and tumble blue collar guys, but this is a crazy lie to make up.
Right.
And for the three people in your audience that are not aware of the Travis Walton incident, I should say that it wasn't an abduction incident in the true sense. The classic abduction cases, as you know, Soraya, follow certain patterns, and it starts very young. Travis was not an abductee, per se. This was not something that was following him throughout his life. It's one of those rare times where somebody was in so the wrong place at so the wrong moment and did the wrong thing. They were coming back from a day of logging. They caught a glow in the sky. They headed toward it. It might be a forest fire. And there is this glowing disc, you know, not that far off the ground, 25 feet, whatever, 30 feet across, clear as day. And, you know, they're transfixed, horrified, amazed. And Travis jumps out of the cab. I think he was all of 22 at the time, and by his own admission was a risk taker. They showed a clip from an old, before I brought him up when it was his turn to speak, from an old Geraldo show where Mike Rogers, who was the crew chief that day, mentioned that Travis was a risk taker. And 2 years before, he remembered watching him chase a bear up a tree. You know, and what happened was he stood under this thing, you know, goofing around like guys do, and then thought better of what he was doing. Meanwhile, his crew members are freaking out in the truck, get back, get back. Yeah. And he makes a move. And we now theorize that it was that move that kind of shocked the intelligences in the craft, or the craft itself, which may be energetic.
Right, right, right.
And that at that point, it shot out this bolt of energy. And he flew 15 or 20 feet, and he landed with steam or smoke coming off of him. And they were sure he was dead.
I would also add into that he could have moved through a particular field of energy of some sort.
Exactly. That, it's all theoretical.
That where it didn't necessarily shoot at him, but it was just a reaction from him moving maybe into a field and then backing back out of it.
All who observed this, and again, this is a very subjective situation, and you're immediately in shock, felt that he was dead.
Right.
And
reasonably.
Yes. No movement at all. They took off. They stopped. They went back. He was gone. And then he was gone for 5 days. The thing that makes it so different than any of the case, besides that it was an isolated event, was that this was a missing persons case. And it went out on the wire services around America.
Right.
But it was superimposed on allegations of a UFO abduction case and then allegations of homicide.
Right.
So the story went international for its prurient interest. And 5 days later, when he was really rather gently returned, and all concerned are open to the possibility that he was killed and that essentially the paddles were put to him and they brought him back. Observed him for a few days and let him go.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what can I say?
Now, he also encountered humans on the craft as well.
Yeah, the very Nordic types and the very spacey types.
Which gets left out of the movie completely.
Yeah.
Because the movie makes it seem like a horror show.
Yeah. Well, what Tracy, the genesis of it was fascinating. And knowing Bud so well and working for him for so many years, I didn't know this little piece of the puzzle. It was quite wonderful to hear from Tracy. He, interest in all subjects, and after Missing Time came out in 1981, he found a copy in a bookstore, read it, felt it was fascinating, was working in New York at the time as a writer for Saturday Night Live, and cold called this painter named Bud Hopkins to question him about this book. Bud invited him over, and Tracy was fascinated by it. Being into UFOs, he was an acquaintance of David Jacobs, who at the time had never heard of Bud Hopkins, had no interest in the nonsensical possibility that aliens were abducting people or whatever you want to call it. And Tracy convinced him that when he was going to go to visit him, that David should come along. Well, David wasn't interested. This guy was crazy, obviously. But he came along. Tracy was impressed, but not convinced. David was neither impressed nor convinced, but went back. And that is when his life changed.
Right.
But Tracy was looking for a case sometime after that that was as good a case as he could take to Hollywood. And he read Travis's book. And no, wait, it was before Travis's book came out. He found him. He called him in Snowflake, Arizona, told him what he was, who he was, what he wanted to do. Travis, who was sitting there while he's talking about this, was reflecting what he was saying very well. He said he was shy, he was reticent to do it, he didn't trust me, but I convinced him at least to meet with me. And I flew out to Phoenix. I rented a vehicle. I said it was going to snow, but please, you know, it's Arizona. I took off, and an hour later, I was in a blizzard with a vehicle with windshield wipers that did not work. And for the last hour, used my hand, got there, spent several days with him. We're in production on the movie. And everything is going okay. And we get a call from the head of the studio, whose name I know, but I won't say here. I think he's still got some clout out there in the world. Who told the director that maybe it even was intruders. I don't know what he saw on television or in the films, but he saw, as part of the film or television show, an archetypical gray abduction treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And he was freaking out. This has been done. Mm. We need something new. And they explained to him, no. This is the way it is. No. We need something new, and if we don't, I am pulling the plug on this picture, oh, and man. I'm taking the loss. And so Tracy and the director and Travis had to sit down together. And one of the things that Travis had always said in describing it, that it was difficult to breathe on board. Ultimately, they worked into sort of an allegory with that, you know, membrane creepy stuff over them. But they couldn't, they were disallowed from presenting what had happened to them. So it was very frustrating for all of them, but that was what actually happened. And it was so interesting to hear from Tracy himself.
And not surprising, because, I mean, that is Hollywood.
Wow.
These people seem to think they know what everyone wants to see, and sometimes they're right, but other times they utterly ruin things that otherwise would have been fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, and just to kind of tie it up, after Tracy, a speaker I've spoken with before, Ben Hansen, who is a former FBI special agent, among other things, in law enforcement, done profiling
was
work.
Was he on Fact of Fake?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
He had his show.
Yep.
On
he seemed really young for being part of the FBI.
Well, I'll tell you what. The fact is he's got one of those faces. But he does have that experience, and he's a big, tall guy. He gave an absolutely fascinating talk as well on, in great part, assessing information based on behavior and the nuances and subtleties that he was taught to look for. And I remember sitting there thinking to myself, oh, good, I do that. Or, yeah, we followed through on that. Yes, we have that kind of test done, et cetera. Saturday ended with me bringing Travis up after a whole bunch of footage from the film, from talk shows that he had done at the time, from talk shows that D.B. Sweeney and Robert Patrick did, also playing the crew chief and Travis. And the point counterpoint, some of the news pieces. It was an incredible talk also. And it really just blew me away. Travis Walton is Travis Walton, and he literally radiates integrity. And I think you could have heard a pin drop in the room, quite honestly.
Nice.
The last day we started, and it was interesting too, we started with some of our very strongest speakers. A lot of conferences do the opposite. They're calculating that you've been up tearing up the hotel bar or night, and
right.
if you're going to blow off a speaker, it's going to be the first one. We started with Stan, with Linda Howe, and the third day with Kathleen Martin, who gave a phenomenal talk about the Betty and Barney Hill case.
Yeah,
I followed with, well, actually, no, we had... Then we had Tracy Torme speak because he wasn't able to speak on Saturday. Then I spoke on Rendlesham, and we ended it with a talk by Thomas Reed, who is, his family has been deeply involved in this subject experientially for more than half a century, with government connections and some foul play, and it's quite a story. But that was the basic conference. There was a Skywatch. We did have the option of going out to the location. And, yeah, we've still got work to do to make this into a smoother venue because of the location. But it was a great weekend.
And the location where this happens is pretty hard to get to, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty straight drive. It's just a long drive.
Oh, okay. I thought it was actually difficult to get up those roads or something.
There are some roads that were a tad challenging, but nothing that, you know, we weren't able to surmount. And nothing that we're not going to keep as a regular part of the event. So, yeah, it was a great couple of days, and here I am back in Ithaca, New York again.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
So, you do have a book out, and it is a free book.
It is.
And it is you want to tell people the title? Because I can never remember the full title.
Yeah, the title is Deliberate Deception, A Case of Disinformation in the UFO Research Community. And you're right, Soraya, it is a new book, and... it was written under non-standard circumstances.
You actually had, when you first started, it started out as a book review.
I did.
And you had talked briefly about it here without realizing it was going to turn into what it did.
It was so ironic.
And I do want to tell people right now, they can go to wheredidtheroadgo.com, and there is a link to download the book right on the main page with the schedule link right now.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this later... It will be in the archive.
That's great. I do appreciate that this book is not available for sale. It is only available at no cost. And that was something that I insisted on. And it is 450 pages. The reason for that and the reason for the book, as you know, Soraya, was last year, my friend Gary Hazeltine, who publishes UFO Truth magazine out of Yorkshire in England, had asked me as a regular columnist, their American columnist, if I would be interested in reviewing the book. And when I say the book, I mean Encounter in Rendlesham Forest by Nick Pope, and then the two first night witnesses of the event, Jim Peniston and John Burroughs.
And who better than you to review such a book?
It's true. I've reviewed lots of books, but I was a good choice for this, objectively speaking. I know all the principles, and I co-wrote a book on the same subject some years back. Hmm. Also, a lot of us were really looking forward to this book. As your informed listeners know, the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident is actually three nights of separate events that form the incident. And Jim and John's event on the first night is very important. And they certainly chose somebody with a lot of above-board visibility, a well-known writer in the UFO field, a career officer in the British Ministry of Defense, now officially retired and living in California, married to an American resident here in the United States. And I picked up an advanced copy of the book when it was available in March, and I started to read it. And I had the damnedest experience. Can I say damn on the radio?
Yes, you can.
Oh, good. Damn. Nice. I'll just think the other words. I started to read it and make my notes for the review. Mm-hmm. And within 15 or 20 pages, something was really wrong for me. I was starting to see what I considered not just errors, but information that was repeatedly taken very specifically from Left at East Gate, the book that I wrote with Larry Warren, a third night eyewitness. And in each case, it was presented in a manner to the reader that was convoluted or incomplete, and if there was evidence or information attached to the allegations, it was not presented. It was never credited, and the one time that it was, or two times, it was credited to erroneous sources. I thought I must be going a little crazy here, or my ego is in overdrive, or Nick's making a tremendous number of extraordinarily bad errors. And ultimately, I came to realize that it was intentional, which was a rather surprising allegation, because it was written, that part, by a friend of mine, or somebody I thought was a friend. And I kind of laid it out on a grid map, a spreadsheet, so to say, and checked every aspect. Part of my problem was, in Left at East Gate, Larry and I endeavored to write the best documented book we could, and so months were added to it. As nonfiction writers that are listening know, annotations and footnotes, I think, numbered about 350, and to make sure everyone was just so is pretty boring work. Encounter in Rendlesham Forest had no footnotes, no annotations, no bibliography, no reading list. No,
which is never a good sign.
No, and we are simply to understand that we are to take the word of the authors. In Jim and John's case, I didn't really have, I had a few problems here and there, but with Nick, it became very difficult. And ultimately, it came down to a question of why had this been done?
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that, you know, your listeners will read the book, and of course we'll go over how to get it and all that stuff, and they can contact me through the station if they have questions about it. But I thought I need to do, originally, the best book review that I can. Because I obviously have issues with this, I need to be super specific, respectful, and in every place that I can, support these guys, all three of them, that I can compliment them, credit them. I need to do it. Because when I come down on them, it's going to be really serious, and it's always going to be extremely specific. I ended up writing a hideously long book review that my editor accepted anyway, and the next day began what I thought would be the outline for a conference paper because, again, I felt this was something that my peers and colleagues and people that follow my work should be aware of. And that got very out of hand, and it got a lot too long for a conference paper. And so, ultimately, I wrote a book.
Kind of accidentally.
Hadn't planned on it. And once the manuscript was pretty much locked down, I sent out copies to a few colleagues, one being Colin Andrews, who I hope will be able to join us in a couple of months when I return. To talk about his thoughts on the book, about the overall behavior that was elicited by Nick, and also on some of the things he's working on right now. Colin, I've been lucky enough to have as a friend since he gave his very first Crop Circle talk in America. We were wow. at the same conference, same docket, in North Haven, Connecticut in the early 90s and just hit it off and have been friends ever since. In fact, he met his then future wife that same weekend, which I thought was very cool. But Colin wrote me back immediately and reminded me that Nick had done almost the exact same thing to him, in that Nick had tried to discredit Colin's extraordinary contributions to Crop Circle research and really attempt to undercut the phenomena itself. And Colin, much to my surprise, reminded me, because it was the only book of his I hadn't read, that when Nick did this, he was so taken aback that he spontaneously wrote a book about, and I thought, well, this
which,
is...
Which book was that?
The perfect title, In Government Circles.
Okay.
And he said, among other things, Nick said that he had never... been requested by the Thatcher government to write two serious reports on the phenomena, or been invited, as I recall, to Buckingham Palace to personally brief Her Majesty the Queen and her husband Prince Philip, that Prince Charles had shown no interest in his work, et cetera, et cetera. And when Travis finally got Nick to agree that what he had said was incorrect, it was 2 years later, and it didn't make a big splash.
Yeah.
But he ended up writing the epilogue for the book, and he sent along a number of letters to back up his allegations, scans. And I looked at the first one, and it was a scan of a letter acknowledging his meeting at Buckingham Palace with the royals on the stationery of the secretary of the Queen of England. My first thought was, very nice stationery. My second thought was, this is good stuff. And as much as any Rendlesham researcher, I thought, I'm probably sitting on as large a database about this very important case as any specialty investigator in it. I've been working it on and off for 26 years.
Right.
And I called my co-author in Liverpool, and we talked about this. And I said, listen, I'm thinking of laying out a lot of our database and giving it away with this book. There is no money to be made. And if we're going to lose money, I'd like to include some of your service record to underscore and a number of relevant photographs. And he said, just do it. And so...
Now, part of the reason you have to do this is because they're accusing Larry of not having been there at all.
They, Jim and John... at the time of the writing of the book, subscribed to that as a possibility, very much under the influence of their former deputy base commander, Charles I. Hall, who has been pushing this nonsensical idea for more than 25 years. Larry outed Charles Hall when he made public the information about the event in his first serious series of interviews with Larry Fawcett, the first UFO investigator he worked with. And when the case broke, and I should stress here, only because of information that Larry Warren supplied Larry Fawcett, it wasn't because a number of witnesses had kicked in information, it caused the result of Colonel Halt's report on the event. Truncated though it was, redacted, minimized, there it is on an Air Force letterhead. It happened and it was real.
Right.
And things have changed quite a bit since the book came out. My book came out, in fact. John Burroughs has very much backed away from supporting the account of his co-author, Jim Peniston.
Really?
Which surprised a lot of us. And in fact, in August, it caught me so off guard, although I was incredibly moved and I felt it was a wonderful development. He contacted Larry Warren, who he has been slagging off for years, and essentially said he felt that he had been very misled. And could they talk? And they not only have been talking, they have become fast friends, exchanged an awful lot of information, found a lot of commonality that they didn't know they had. And in September, they spoke together at a conference in Woodbridge, England. And I'm very proud of John. I think it takes a big man to do what he did. And we'll go into some of the specifics in a bit. But as I pulled this appendix together, I realized that although this book is something of an expose of the way that deceptions function in UFO studies and in other controversial subjects, and how elegantly you can slip something over on the reader, even an informed reader.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think what Nick Pope did was masterful in a way. And for me, it shows professional training. I don't see it as an amateur job. Whether or not Nick did it of his own volition and chose to, or was asked to do it, or was ordered to do it, which sounds rather theatrical, but it's not out of the question.
Sure.
There are certain positions in this world that you may never fully retire from.
Right.
CIA or MI6, the NSA or the mob, and I don't mean to be funny.
No, but it's...
You know, you're in.
Yeah, yeah.
And why would Nick do something like that? Well, our book came out in England in the summer, in fact, in June of 1997. And let's remember that that was the summer marking the 50th anniversary of Roswell, the Kenneth Arnold sightings, in fact, the modern age of UFOs. And England and America, among other places, went a little UFO crazy. All the old documentaries were trotted out on both sides of the Atlantic. There were a lot of one-off glossy magazines, a spate on both sides of the Atlantic of new UFO magazines, some short-lived. And Nick, who believed very much in our book and wrote us not just as fine a quote for the outside of the book as we've ever had, but also of his own volition, completely surprising us, wrote a review, and a very positive review of our book, for, of all publications, the Ministry of Defense's own in-house monthly publication, Focus. 58,000 circulation. You can imagine some of the movers and shakers it went out to. In doing so, Nick helped, in his way, to bring attention to the book and really helped it become a genuine top 10 bestseller that summer. The result of that was some very serious embarrassment to Her Majesty's government, nothing less than the nuclear treaty violation that we break in the story. And I, even at this point, I will not stand for people slagging off Nick for the wrong reasons.
Right. If you're going to criticize someone, make it for the right
reasons.
That's
right. If you're going to have an opinion, make it an informed one. There is no one I know that is more a patriot of the Her Majesty's government than Nick Pope. There is no one I know more loyal to his security oath who worked for Her Majesty's government than Nick. And I can understand if he felt, as the years passed, that maybe he should try to take the wheels out from under a very important book that caused a great deal of upset for the ministry, etc. And in a convoluted way, I have to respect that. At the same time, I think it's a shame. I don't know how he thought I would react or not react. And I feel bad for him because he lost a good friend.
Has he actually, have you talked to him at all? Has he?
I haven't. I could, I guess, just call him sometime. But the only thing I'd have to ask him, he wouldn't answer, which would be those questions. Hmm. Otherwise, I wish him well, but I have no desire really to talk to him. However, I have made it clear, as you know, to every host whose radio show I've been on, didn't do it on this one, we did it once before, to invite Nick to be on the show and have whomever was the producer or the host MC a discussion.
Mm-hmm.
He's turned all my requests down so far. I hope at some point in the future, on an acceptable venue for him, maybe it needs to be coast to coast or something, or at a conference, that he would consider going one-to-one with me, or he can bring on Charles Halt with him and Jim Peniston, whomever else he'd like. I'd love to have Larry with me and possibly Jim, even Colin Andrews. In other words, I'd really like to discuss this with him in an open forum.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to do it, though, and that's kind of a shame.
And if he did it to Colin as well, it's kind of a seems to be his thing, unfortunately. So, the first part of Deception is the main text, and everything else is kind of appendixes with all your different information. So the main text runs about, what, 100 pages?
Yeah, and that would include Colin's epilogue.
Right.
We have about 300 or so pages of documents, letters, memos, maps, drawings, communications between the military, ever so many of the players, and then at least 50 pages of photos that are relevant to the story. All I ask, because again, I guess in some ways I am very much a product of the 60s. I function on idealism more than practicality at times. And what I thought was the charges I am making are so grave against a very well-known colleague. I don't want anyone to think for a moment that there was any financial motivation in this.
Right, right.
And I can tell you that I spent between six and 700 absolutely dead-on focus hours working on the manuscript, originally the book review, reviewing, tightening, making it as objective and even-handed as I could, and not wanting to appear because there had been some word in the air that what was being put forward was that I was feeling left out because our book was published so many years ago, and now the spotlight was on other people. Well, please, give me a break.
Well, not only that, but this book was claiming to be the first book written by the actual witnesses, and in truth, that was your book with Larry.
Yeah, and there were a lot of small as well as large errors. And I say conscious because I know Nick read the book. He read the manuscript in 1996. Mm. He certainly had a copy of the book. And based on how many details he brings up in his book that are not credited again, logic would suggest that he had to at least check through it. And, you know, the small ones got to me in some cases as much as the big ones. For example, this is a perfect example. Larry Warren has always said that on the third night, the event that he witnessed, there were three beings that appeared outside of the craft, the structured, whatever it was, that a light came in from the North Sea, a reddish light, exploded with magnesium brightness, and when their eyes adjusted, they were looking at this thing in a ground fog. Nick actually says that, number one, Warren says he observed two or three beings, that they were on the inside of the ship, and that while it was going on, there were other lights in the sky shooting down beams of light to the ground. Now, there's no record of anybody ever saying any of these things anywhere, least of all Larry. And, you know, that's why Nick is never going to comment on them, because he has no source, because they don't exist as far as I know. And again, I'd like to call him on that. But here's the thing. If you say that somebody says that they saw two or three of something, you know, it's sort of a passing remark.
Mm-hmm.
If I say, Soraya, I'm not sure whether I saw 19 or 20, you could say, well, who is? Or certainly 49 or 50. When you even suggest that somebody doesn't know the difference between two or three, I mean, think about the implications.
Yeah. It's a subtle way to make him seem less of a good witness.
Yes, no question about it. And an officer who we have always maintained, and Larry saw him, was the base wing commander, Gordon Williams, came out to the field that night and literally had a face-off with these beings. In the text, Nick says an officer was, Warren alleges that there was an officer out there, either Halt or Williams. And Larry has never said, insinuated, suggested, written, or stated that it was Halt. These things are simply incorrect. If there is a source that Nick can cite, I can say, oh, well, gee, yeah, they printed it wrong.
Right.
I'd like to know what it is, but there isn't one, I'm sure.
All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be back in a minute with Peter Robbins here on Where Did the Road Go?
Where Did the Road Go can be heard first and usually live on WVBR, Saturday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern. Go to wheredidtheroadgo.com to ask questions of our live guests through the chat room. Where Did the Road Go is then re-aired on Dark Matter Radio and Deprogrammed Radio. You can download all shows for free on the website, and you can subscribe to us on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, or Vimeo. Additional content can be found on our video channels. You will also find our upcoming schedule, book reviews, blogs, free book downloads, links, and more. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and if you want to help support the show, there are links to donate to us. Everything you need can be found at wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And we are talking tonight with Peter Robbins about his latest book. And this book is available. Now, originally it was put out by Phenomena Magazine.
Yes.
And I got the wrong mic on again. Why did I do that twice? Bad enough I did it once. All right. So it was put out by Phenomena Magazine out of the UK.
That's right. And in order to get the book, real simple, go to the Where Did the Road Go website and download it.
And that's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
Yeah. And again, it is called Deliberate Deception, A Case of Disinformation in the UFO Research Community. What I would like to think is exciting to a reader, whether or not they are extremely informed about the subject of UFOs or whether or not it's their first book on the subject, they have an opportunity to dive into a objective, critical analysis of part of the case, and then they have, for the first time ever, the largest database ever made public for them to go through and make their own deductions about it. All I ask, because it is free, is that you read it, and if you feel that I make my case within a reasonable doubt, that you share it with other people.
There you go. And it should be available on the Phenomena Magazine site as well. There seems to be an issue there.
Most certainly. There does seem to be an issue at the moment. I'll check it out tomorrow. Otherwise, if you go to Phenomena Magazine.
.co.uk.
Yeah. Get their nice website, and thank you for that reminder. They're in Manchester, a great city, and home of a very important football team. We call it soccer. You go to their page, and there is a box that says Special Reports. You click on that box, and it takes you to seven book icons on a cyber shelf.
It's on a Google Drive.
Right. And you just download it in order, and it's yours.
Yeah. Currently, that's not working, though. And so if you want it, I have zipped all those files together. They are available as a zip file on wheredidtheroadgo.com. If you're listening to this later on, as opposed to the live show, it will be on the archive entry. And hopefully I'm going to have a free book section very soon on the website, because I also have Roy Davies' book up there. If you want the link for that, it's on our Facebook page at the moment, but it will be in the in his interview, and it will be on, like I said, a free book section I'm going to put together.
Very cool.
And if you have any questions for Peter live right now, if you're listening Saturday night, you can come into the chat room at wheredidtheroadgo.com, and I'll pass them along to Peter.
Great.
Now, one of the things, one of the big things about this book that Nick Pope and the others put out was this binary code that Jim got.
Right.
And this was made, there was such a big deal made about this. Now, this was like evidence of time travelers and an explanation for Rendlesham and the whole thing. And when you read the book, were you, how did you feel?
That there was no there there. For several years now, Jim Peniston, who is the first night witness who alleges that this code was downloaded into his head when he touched a figure, a symbol, a hieroglyph, a number, a letter, whatever you want to call it, on the side of the craft that was observed on the first night. Now, for me, when Jim made this public for the first time, even though it had been made public in small ways, or it had been shared for many years before, Jim made it public in late December of 2010 at the 30th anniversary conference in Woodbridge, England. And at the time, the audience reacted quite emotionally. They asked what the message was. He gave them a basic idea, but would not put it all on the record because he was on a non-disclosure agreement with the History Channel for a television program, I think, in the Ancient Aliens series that was going to be shown in 2011.
Was it?
The program came and went without any proof of...
So it did air.
Yeah.
Okay.
But without any proof of time travel. Then they were going to give it at a conference the following year, again back in Woodbridge. They decided not to take part in that conference. And then they announced they'd be working on a book and that that was where they'd present their findings and that it would be quite definitive. Well, it wasn't definitive. Not at all. Part of the problem, and I think, and I really, I can only imagine what it was like for John Burroughs, was that in writing the book with Nick Pope, who, again, after more than 20 years in the Ministry of Defense, really cannot write a book without being reviewed by his old employers, or in his term, government masters. and the Department of Defense also decided to review the book, which means censor it, which they probably would not have done if it was just two retired Air Force sergeants writing about an allegation of a UFO event.
Right.
And so if there was anything of unique value, of importance, of a new part of the story, new evidence, it never made it into the manuscript. And on the back of the book, the lead liner note is, I think it's obviously written by Nick, but is this is the first book in UFO history, or the only one to ever request clearance from two major governments, which is a nice way of saying this book has been castrated.
Yes.
And
it's very
new.
Clever to put it out there like it's a bragging right.
Wow. Two world governments. I am impressed until you read it. And it occurred to me early on that the likelihood, and with all due respect, who am I to say who the intelligences were behind this extraordinary series of events, but the likelihood that a sergeant in the United States Air Force at the time was singled out for to receive a message for humanity from time travelers from our future to be delivered at a later date. I started to examine this from every view that I could, and I may be wrong, but I'm as sure as I can be that Jim was not contacted by time travelers, and that he was and remains the victim of a highly sophisticated, ongoing disinformation program designed to take attention away from the less sensational but more important extraordinary scientific findings that have been building up around Rendlesham and historic evidences for 30 years now, to which my co-author and I have contributed. The idea for me, it's so ironic to think that at this moment in world history, even if you don't take UFOs seriously, if you were to really study the Rendlesham Forest event, it might be tenable to you that it fell into that possible realm of having a truly anomalous UFO-related explanation.
Right.
When you say time travelers from our future, most eyebrows go up. It's a wink-wink and a nudge-nudge. Yes, futurists embrace time travel. It's around the corner. There are all these great theories, you know, by PhDs, but it ain't happening right now that we're aware of. And I guess it was in August, again, that John Burroughs made it clear to those of us that follow what he says, for the first time, that it's not that he ever denied it, but he never corrected what Jim was putting on the record in terms of John made it very clear that he has no memory of seeing the craft, and he has no memory of Jim walking up to the craft. Mm. He also has problems with Jim's time sequence in a number of respects, as he writes. He also feels that Charles Halt, his former deputy base commander, who he did quite a lot of media with, has misled him tremendously and has essentially treated him now the way he's treated Larry Warren for all these years.
Yeah.
And I feel particularly bad for Jim. There is no discussing this with him. If you are not an acolyte or not a believer, and you even respectfully try to express a difference of opinion, he will cease communicating with you. He, like his co-authors, received advance copies of the links to download my book, mm-hmm. as I requested the publisher send them, with the understanding that anything that they wanted to say response to what I had written would be published and released on the same basis, and everybody that reads that very big subscription magazine would have a chance to see it.
Yeah.
Nick didn't respond, and Jim responded that he had no need to read a book on a subject that he had already researched. Okay, then. When you read this book, folks, you will see that I come down particularly hard on John Burroughs in places. I think they're warranted because I think a lot of his anger, a lot of the way his PTSD was coming out, was directed at my co-author, who he had been conditioned to believe was a wannabe or had been messed with or simply constructed this thing because he wanted to feel special or was a Manchurian candidate or something. He understands otherwise now. And again, to his credit, I think I probably would have left out some of the references had I written it more contemporaneously, because when I say deliberate deception as the main title of the book, I'm not talking about Jim or John. I am talking about Nick's writing.
Yeah.
I think, in fact, that they were completely unaware of it, like almost all readers would be, because of how it into the fabric of the text. And again, very skillfully, you wouldn't recognize those points of, I can't even call it theft or plagiarism, because if you take something and then you convolute it to such a degree, it misses the definition. Again, I just hope people will read it.
Repurposing the facts.
And decide for themselves. And if they have an opportunity to put any of these questions to Nick in a radio show or in a public forum, a conference or anything, if they're curious, I hope they will.
All right. And the code itself was a series of binary numbers sketched on a notepad. Now, you said that, I mean, he went public with it, but he claims that he didn't even know the term binary before a certain point. This is Jim. But yet, was it Linda Moulton Howe who, in an interview, he says there was a binary sequence, or?
He says it a couple of times before he actually says it. Nick begins that chapter by saying, for 30 years, Jim Peniston kept a secret. Well, he did, except for the people that he didn't keep the secret with. And one of them was somebody he did a hypnotic regression with in either 1994 or 6.
Okay.
Arguably, you know, either 14 or 16 years before the event when he made the truth apparent, or the truth as he understands it, where he mentions binary code. John Burroughs has been on record as saying he never heard a reference to it, heard of it, or Jim never discussed it until October of 2010.
Right.
He's right there that night, but yet it's almost 30 years before he learns about it. Colonel Halt, who again has been playing both sides to a degree, wrote a year ago, a little more than a year ago, in an article he wrote for UFO Truth magazine in the UK, that he had seen that notebook on quite a number of times over the years, certainly after the service as well, because they worked on documentaries together, but he had never seen those pages of ones and zeros. Jim writes in his own book, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, how could I, 24 hours later, in my room, write out the 16 pages, I think that's what it was, in a mm-hmm. small loose-leaf binder, of ones and zeros, thousands of them. And what it is, a real binary code. I maintain that it's not from time travelers, but it is a code.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is kind of, for me, kind of a new age dream. Each one of these longitude and latitudes relates to a very loaded piece of real estate, whether it's Sedona, Arizona, a mythical sunken island off the coast of Ireland, a location in India.
And that was High Brazil.
Yes.
And that is also, as Graham Hancock has shown, possibly above water during the last ice age. So there is an island there, but it's underwater at the moment.
Yes. All very intriguing.
Yeah.
And then a series of statements that would be very comfortable in a good or not so good science fiction movie. And I think the hope is, by those who take this seriously, that new information, new techniques, whatever, will somehow be able to put this information together in a manner that convinces us that it proves that time travel is real and that the intelligence behind the event were time travelers rather than who the heck knows who. And that is a category I'm in right now. I do think it is truly anomalous. I'm convinced of it. But who the intelligence is where, I have no way of knowing.
You're on WVBR FM Ithaca. We've been talking with Peter Robbins. And so the thing, when you pointed that out, that it sounded like something that was coming from like a channeling or something, and that's exactly what it sounded like. It was too perfect.
Yeah.
It was too, I don't know. That it just, as soon as you said that, it was like, yes, that's exactly what it is. And John Keel observed this too, that a lot of messages that would come through UFO contactees
right.
back in the 60s were the same thing that were being channeled in the 30s and 20s and such.
Yes.
Through, and it was like the same material, which makes you think they're not making it up.
Yeah.
But what is it really coming from? Because none of it ever pans out.
Yeah.
None of it really means anything. It's almost like nonsense, but it's not actually nonsense.
Yeah. It's a very good way to say it, in fact. And a concern that comes out of that for me is, I think when people read my book, if they give a careful reading to Jim Johns and Nick's book, common sense and logic, critical thinking, may suggest to them, as to me, that this is a very terrestrial source and not, you know, a foreign one.
Right.
But we can't know for sure. And I wouldn't dream to say I know definitively. I'm just more sure as I can be that this is the way it is. And the story will continue to develop, Soraya. There's no question about it.
Now, do you think this code actually came to Jim on the night that it happened, or do you think it was maybe implanted later?
Well, that's another very important question. John, again, has no memory of the circumstances, the craft, the touching, learning anything about it for almost 30 years. Jim, by his own statement in their book, and it's one of the most poignant parts of the book, says, I remember undergoing at least 14, he called them debriefings, a number of them involving injections of something, which some folks theorized was sodium pentothal.
Right.
More likely, if it was in that family, it was sodium amethyl. Pentothal is a good tool to help convince you to tell the truth, even if you don't want to.
Right.
Amethyl is a better drug to use if you want to put a lie into somebody's mind and have them believe it. And that a couple of these debriefings, if you want to call them that, they weren't Air Force personnel. They were guys in suits who could be anybody.
Yeah.
So I feel very bad for Jim Pennison, but there's no way to break through and convince him otherwise. He is deeply inset into this thought, and that's where it is right now.
And I would think that these guys, having had those debriefings, if you want to call them that, have definitely sort of compromised their memories of the events.
And that's another thing all parties agree on, Jim, John, and Larry included, that there are certain memories that none of them can be absolutely sure are authentic conventional memories in the form that we remember things, or whether these things were put in their head as a false memory, so to say.
Yeah. And the time travel thing, I hadn't really thought about it as a method of sort of alienating the subject from people, but I see something similar happen with David Politis's stuff, his missing 411 work. I'm not sure if you're that familiar with it, but I've seen a number of people who are clearly not fans of David's come up and try to make a connection between these missing people in national parks, which David has been very, very careful to keep separate from his Bigfoot work, and they'll come in and say, well, David just thinks Bigfoot is kidnapping people. And that, I think, whereas you can approach someone and say, well, look, here's a list of missing people under odd circumstances, and they have a lot in common, and they're in certain areas. And someone might take that seriously and say, well, that's really interesting. But the minute you throw Bigfoot's taking them in, they'll go, well, I'm not going to take this. I'm not even going to look at this.
You know, I remember discussing this at an earlier show.
I think, actually, we talked about it on the interview we did at your house, which I haven't posted yet.
Oh, for goodness sakes. Okay.
And so, I mean, but it's the same type of technique. You connect it to something that is marginalized.
That's right.
And, you know, when you take time travel and you mix it in with, you know, a UFO account to begin with, which is already borderline marginalized, it really just kind of makes people go, well, I'm not even going to look twice at this. And especially with Rendlesham being such a solid, good case. It's not, oh, someone saw light in the sky. It's a major account at a major military base in the UK, well-documented with lots of evidence. That's something you want. If you want to make it go away, the easiest way to do it is to attach it to something like, oh, it was time travelers from the future. Because people are starting to accept the idea that alien life is out there.
Yeah.
So you got to make it crazier.
Well, in a way, you've absolutely hit it on the head. I was disappointed to see that in Nick Pope's discussion about ruminations over the idea of the time travel theory, he looks at it from every point of view, that it may be a code within a code. He never once questions the possibility that the code is not from time travelers, but is part of a disinformation operation. And again, in writing nonfiction, especially around controversial subjects, you do your best to concede as many points as possible to be fair.
Sure.
As far as the marginalization goes, I was so surprised to see he never even entertained the possibility of it being a disinformation operation or generated from others rather than time travelers. He's extremely serious and respectful, almost more so than warranted, because we are completely left out of his thinking on that possibility. And there's something, as I think your readers will pick up on, that rings as very inauthentic there.
And the other thing is, I mean, the idea of the UFO phenomenon being people from the future is not a new one. It's been out there, but it's never been a primary theory. It's just one of the possibilities. So, I mean, it is possible that whatever happened at Rendlesham was from the
Anything's
future.
Anything's possible.
Exactly, because until we know the absolute truth of what's going on, anything, you know, all bets are off.
In this case, it all, not most of it, but it all hinges on the belief of one individual and information which was put into his head that there is no way that I'm aware of that one can truly establish its sources being extraterrestrial, interdimensional, extremely human, or otherwise.
Right, right. The other thing is, and I know you had some experiences when you went to investigate Rendlesham, that you saw a bunch of lights putting on almost a show for you. There have been other events at Rendlesham Forest. This wasn't a one-off situation.
No, it's an area with a very high statistical prevalence of unidentified flying objects, for starters. One of the most famous cases in Project Blue Book was the 1956 Lincoln Heath case, which is really right just down the road, and involved hard radar returns, metal objects going thousands of miles an hour over that area in 1956. Observed radar returns, pilot visuals, on-the-ground visuals. It's also an area that continues to have high areas of UFO sightings, as well as ghost, poltergeist incidents, different anomalies, not to mention the fact that for 100 years now, it has been a fairly well-militarized area, going back to testing of mustard gas and other World War I secret weapons at the time. It's also an area with NSA listening posts now. It's very beautiful, very pastoral. It's a part of England I love very much, but that's a heck of a piece of real estate.
And it also has some legends that go back hundreds and hundreds of years.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, to say that time travelers made one appearance here and talked to Jim when all this other stuff is also going on, it seems like there's probably a more likely explanation, whatever that explanation would be, unless time travelers are going there on a constant basis.
Again, I'm open to anything that can increase our knowledge on this.
Sure.
And anything that can be presented in as evidence. One of my basic rules is go into an investigation, whether it's an afternoon or a decade, with no agenda whatsoever. Follow the evidence wherever it takes you. Be as honest as you can and as clear-thinking as you can in reporting it, and always tell the truth. And we have problems with this case. In next month, it's going to be 34 years.
Wow.
And it is still a live wire in ufology, and bet that it is going to continue. In fact, one kind of closing note was one of the conferences I worked on helping to organize this year was the New England UFO Conference, which took place last month in Leominster, Massachusetts. And for me, although we had first-rate speakers there, the most memorable speaker was a guy named Steve LaPlume. Steve was law enforcement in the Air Force at Bentwaters, like Jim and John were. He knew Larry. He knew the other guys. He was not involved on those three nights, but he was involved in a sighting event some weeks later that was major, life-changing. And it did change his life. And he happened to grow up and be born in that town. And for the second time ever, the first time being over 30 years ago and only once, he got out in front of a crowd and he talked about his experience, his memories, and it was very poignant. There was a sister in the front row, a recently retired police officer in that town, and Steve was put through hell. Steve was put through hell. It was one more account added, and again, this was just last month. So look for more on this story as we move into the future.
All right. Well, I thank you once again for joining us here.
And always a pleasure, sir.
You can find Peter's book currently at wheredidtherodgo.com. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it'll be in the archive. And hopefully I'll have a free book section up too. So if you see a section that says free books, it'll definitely be in there. And hopefully it'll be back on Phenomena Magazine's site, which is phenomenamagazine.co.uk. And they're the ones who initially put it out. But there's a glitch, obviously, with their system at the moment. And yeah, we'll have you back maybe with some special guests next year. And because we've talked about bringing a few people in while you're here to make it more interesting.
Indeed.
All right. So we're going to take you out with some Psyche Corporation, and this is Whirring World, and we will be back next week with, I believe, Jim Harold, and talking about his latest campfire ghost stories. Campfire stories? True ghost stories. Campfire Tales, book 3, I think. I totally mangled that. All right. We'll see you next week.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection? Singing soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Whence came this dream that bugs my mind? Behind a curtain, outside of time. Can you hear the ballet plays? The whirring of the world. Of the universe, ventricles and atria, chambers number 1597, and counting. Can you hear?